happened in London? Martin Wentworth was shouting. He had risen to his feet. Now is the time we need the Clave's assistance. It's a quarantine, Martin, said Will in his steady voice. Let the Inquisitor explain. But it was Charles who spoke. All of you, he said loudly. You know that Barbara Lightwood was stricken down by a demon attack. Poison flooded her system. She could not withstand it and died a few days ago. Thomas winced, and Martin Wentworth's face turned from red to white as he clearly thought of his son, Piers. Charles went on. Oliver Heywood was with her when she died. In the last throes of her agony, not recognizing her friends and loved ones, she attacked him, scratching and hitting him. Lucy remembered the blood on Oliver's hands, his cuffs. The library was silent. She could not bear to look at Thomas. As you may also know, Charles went on, the Heywood family runs the York Institute, and Oliver understandably wished to return home after losing his beloved. As any upstanding young man might well do, muttered Bridgestock. Charles ignored this. We received the news yesterday that Oliver had fallen ill. His scratches festered and he was overcome by the same symptoms that have claimed those here in London who have been attacked by these demons. He paused. Oliver died this morning. There was an audible gasp. Lucy felt sick. Lawrence Ashdown bolted to his feet. But Heywood wasn't attacked by a demon, nor is the poison of demons contagious. The poison causes an ailment, said Will calmly. It has been determined by the Silent Brothers that this ailment can be transmitted by bite or scratch. While it is not highly contagious, it is contagious nonetheless. Hence the quarantine. Is that why all the sick were moved to the Silent City and are not being allowed visitors? Is that what's going on? Demanded Wentworth. Lucy was again startled. She had not known the sick were not to be visited. Thomas, noting her distress, whispered, The injunction against visitors was handed down only this morning. Christopher and I heard Uncle Gabriel discussing it. The Silent City is the right place for them to be, said Charles. The brothers can take the best care of the afflicted, and no demon can enter the place.
So what's the Clave's plan?
Ida Rosewayne's voice rose.
Is their intention to trap us in London, with demons carrying a poison disease we don't know how to treat, so we all simply die?
Even Bridgestock looked taken aback. It was Will who spoke. We are shadow hunters, he said. We do not wait to be saved by others. We save ourselves. We here in London are as equipped as any member of the Clave to solve this problem, and it will be solved. Lucy felt a spark of warmth in her chest. Her father was a good leader. It was one of the things she loved about him. He knew when people needed to be calmed and encouraged. Charles, who wanted so badly to be a leader himself, knew only how to frighten and demand. Will is correct, Charles said cautiously. We have the assistance of the Silent Brothers, and I myself will be acting as consul in my mother's stead, since she cannot return from Idris. Charles glanced into the crowd and, for a moment, seemed to be looking directly at Alistair Carstairs. Odd that he was there, Lucy thought, but Sonar was not, though Alistair would certainly report on the state of things to his family. Alistair returned Charles's glance and looked away. Lucy sensed Thomas's shoulder tense beside hers. We will be splitting into three groups, said Bridgestock. One group will be in charge of research, digging up everything in our libraries regarding whether anything like this has happened before, demon disease, demons that can exist in daylight, and so on. Group two will handle night patrols, and group three, day patrols. Every shadow hunter over the age of 18 and under the age of 55 will be given an area of London to patrol.
I do not see why the demons would remain within the boundaries of the city, said Lillian Highsmith darkly. We may be quarantined, but they are not.
We have not been abandoned, said Will. York, too, is under quarantine, though there have been no further cases of illness there yet. But the shadow hunters of the Cornwall Institute, as well as some shadow hunters from Idris, will be patrolling outside London, and patrols will be stepped up all through the British Isles. If the demons flee London, they will be caught. These demons didn't just appear out of thin air, said Bridgestock. They were summoned. We need to interrogate all the magic users in London in order to track down the culprit.
It's not quite demons, is it? Lucy whispered. If it's a manticore, then it's really just one demon. Maybe, ought we to tell them?
Not at the moment, said Thomas. The last thing they need is us falling out of the ceiling to announce that we have a theory that it's a demon that splits into parts. In fact, not even so much as a theory as a hypothesis, said Christopher. We have not proved it yet or even tested it, and I am not sure how it will change their plans or behaviour. It may be one demon, but it acts as many demons, and that is what they are seeking to combat. In the library, Will frowned. Morris, we've been over this. Not only will such an action panic all the magicians and downworlders in London, we have no assurance that whoever raised these demons is even still in the city. It will be a waste of manpower that we need elsewhere. But someone is at fault for this and must pay for it, snapped Bridgestock. Will began to say, surprisingly gently, and that will happen, but we must find this demon first. My daughter is dying, Bridgestock shouted, suddenly enough to jolt the room. Ariadne is dying, and I demand to know who is responsible. Well, my niece is already dead.
It was Uncle Gabriel, having risen to his feet.
He looked furious, his green eyes nearly black. Lucy rather wished her Aunt Cecily was there, for she would surely have been cheering him on. And yet, rather than wasting my energy on imagining revenge, I will be patrolling London's streets, hoping to prevent what happened to her from happening to another innocent, well and good Lightwood, said Bridgestock, his eyes glittering. But I am the Inquisitor, and you are not. It is my task to root out evil at its source.
The view went dark, and the library below vanished. Lucy glanced up in surprise to see that Thomas had drawn a line through her room, closing their window to the library below. His eyes, like his Uncle Gabriel's, were glittering with fury. Christopher put his hand on Thomas's shoulder.
I'm sorry, Tom, about Oliver, and there's no need to apologize.
Thomas spoke in a tight voice.
It is best we know the situation. As soon as we have hold of the Pyxis, we will handle this ourselves, for if we wait for the Enclave to come to a consensus, I expect more will die.
James watched as Cordelia ascended the steps to the raised cherrywood stage in the middle of the room. He was aware of Matthew standing beside him, swearing under his breath. He didn't blame him. He knew how his parabatai felt, that somehow they had thrown Cordelia to the wolves of the Hell Ruel. Kellington, standing beside her, clapped his hands, and the crowd began to quiet. Not fast enough, James thought. He began to applaud loudly, and beside him, following his lead, Matthew did the same. Anna, snuggling next to Hypatia on the settee, also clapped, causing Kellington to glance toward her and frown. Hypatia looked back at him with wide, starry eyes and shrugged. Kellington cleared his throat.
Honoured guests, he said. Tonight we have something unusual. A shadow hunter has offered to entertain us.
A murmur ran through the room. James and Matthew kept clapping, and a dark-haired vampire girl with bright combs in her hair joined in the applause. Anna leaned over and whispered in Hypatia's ear.
Please enjoy the performance of the lovely Cordelia Carstairs,
Kellington said, hastily turning to descend the stairs. Cordelia laid a hand on his arm. I will require you to accompany me, she said, on the violin. Matthew chuckled almost reluctantly. She is clever, he said, as Kellington, looking annoyed, strode off to retrieve his instrument. As he moved through the crowd, Cordelia, looking far calmer than James suspected she was, reached up and unpinned her hair. James caught his breath as it fell down around her shoulders, spilled down her back, the deep red of rose petals. It stroked her bare brown skin like silk. Her glowing bronze dress clung to her as she reached back and unsheathed Cortana, drawing it forward. Every glittering light in the Hellruel caught fire along the blade. I have always loved stories, she said, and her clear voice carried through the room. One of my favourite tales is that of the servant girl, Tarwadood. After the death of a rich merchant, his son wasted all the inheritance he got until he had nothing left but one servant, a girl known through all the caliphate for her brilliance and her beauty. Her name was Tarwadood. She begged the son to take her to the court of the caliph, Harun al-Rashid, and there to sell her for a vast sum of money. The son insisted he could not get such a princely sum for the sale of one servant. Tarwadood insisted she would convince the caliph that there was no wiser or more eloquent or learned woman in all the land but she. Eventually the son was worn down. He brought her to the court, and she came before the caliph, and she told him this. Cordelia nodded at Kellington, who had come to stand beside the stage. He began to play a haunting tune on the violin, and Cordelia began to move. It was a dance, but not a dance. She moved fluidly with Cortana. It was gold, and she followed that gold in fire. She spoke, and her low, husky voice matched the dance and the music of the violin. Oh, my lord, I am versed in syntax and poetry and jurisprudence and exegesis and philosophy. I am skilled in music and in the knowledge of the divine ordinances and in arithmetic and geodesy and geometry and the fables of the ancients. Cortana wove with her words, underlining each one with steel. She turned as her sword turned, and her body curved and moved like water or fire, like a river under an infinity of stars. It was beautiful. She was beautiful. But it was not a distant beauty. It was a beauty that lived and breathed and reached out with its hands to crush James's chest and make him breathless. I have studied the exact sciences, geometry and philosophy, and medicine and logic and rhetoric and composition. Cordelia sank to her knees, her sword whipped around her, a narrow circlet of fire. The violin sang, and her body sang, and James could see the court of the caliph and the brave girl kneeling before Harun al-Rashid and telling him of her worth. I can play the lute and know its gamut and notes and notation and the crescendo and diminuendo. Beside James, Matthew sucked in his breath. James glanced quickly at his parabatai. Matthew. Matthew looked as he did sometimes when he thought no one was watching him. There was a haunted loneliness in that look, a desire almost beyond comprehension for something even Matthew himself did not understand. His gaze was fixed on Cordelia. But then everyone in the room was looking at her as her body bent backward and her hair swept from side to side, an arc of fire. Her brown skin glowed, perspiration glimmered on her collarbones. James's blood was pounding through his body like a river through a broken dam. If I sing and dance, I seduce. Cordelia straightened with a snap. Her eyes met the gaze of her audience, direct and challenging. And if I dress and scent myself, I slay. She slammed Cortana into its sheath. Kellington had stopped playing the violin. He, too, was staring at Cordelia like a lovesick sheep. James had an overwhelming urge to kick him. Cordelia rose to her feet, her chest rising and falling with her quick breath. And wise men were brought from all around the land to test Tawadud, but she was wiser than them all. So wise and beautiful was she that in the end the caliph granted her whatever it was she wanted, all the wishes of her heart. Cordelia bowed. "And that is the end of the story," she said, and began to descend the steps. Cordelia had never been stared at by so many people in her life. Escaping the stage, she slithered into the crowd, though it was a different crowd than it had been. Everyone seemed to want to smile at her now, or incline their heads or wink. Several downworlders said, "Beautifully done," as she passed. She murmured her thanks and was immensely grateful when she reached James and Matthew. James seemed completely composed. Matthew was looking at her with wide eyes. "Bloody hell," he said admiringly as soon as she came into range. He looked far more serious than he usually did. "What was that?" "It was a fairy tale," James said briefly. "Well done, Cordelia." He indicated the now empty Jacquard settee. "Anna has disappeared with Hypatia, so I would call your distraction a success." Cordelia. He had not called her Daisy. She didn't know what to think of that. She put a hand to her chest. Her heart was pounding, from nerves and from the dancing. "What do we do now?" she said. "How long does seduction usually last?"
"Depends if you do it properly," said Matthew, with a little of his old grin. "Well, I hope for Hypatia's sake that Anna does it properly, yet for our sake I hope she hurries it up," said James.
Matthew had gone still. "Both of you," he said, "listen." Cordelia listened, and heard at first only the buzz and murmur of the crowd, then beneath it, the whisper of a familiar word, spoken low and urgently. "A shadow hunter. A shadow hunter is here."
"Do they mean us?"
She looked around in puzzlement and saw Kellington gazing toward the door, his mouth flat with irritation. Someone had just come into the chamber. Someone with bright red hair, wearing a heavy tweed coat.
"Charles."
Matthew's eyes were green slits.
"By the angel. What is he doing here?"
James swore softly. Charles was moving through the crowd, his coat buttoned to the throat, looking around uncomfortably. He looked desperately out of place.
"We should go," James said.
"But we can't leave Anna."
"You two run and hide yourselves," said Matthew. "Charles will go off his head if he sees you here."
"But what about you?" said Cordelia.
"He's used to this kind of thing from me," Matthew said, and his whole face seemed to have tightened.
His eyes were glittering like chips of glass.
"I'll deal with Charles."
James looked at Matthew for a long moment. Cordelia sensed the whisper of unspoken words passing between them, the silent communication of Parapatai. Perhaps one day she would have that with Lucy. At the moment, it seemed almost like magic. James nodded at Matthew, turned, and caught hold of Cordelia's hand.
"This way," he said, and they plunged into the crowd.
Behind her, Cordelia heard Matthew say Charles's name with exaggerated loud surprise. The crowd was shifting and moving as downworlders flinched away from Charles. James and Cordelia edged around Kellington and into a red-panelled corridor leading away from the main chamber. There was an open door about halfway down the corridor. A plaque on the door proclaimed it to be the Whispering Room. James ducked into it, drawing Cordelia after him. She had time only to see that they were in a dimly lit, deserted room when he slammed the door behind them. She leaned against the wall, catching her breath, as they both looked around. They were in a sort of parlour, or perhaps an office. The walls were hung with silver paper, decorated with images of golden scales and feathers. There was a tall walnut desk, large as a table, with a raised surface piled with neat stacks of writing paper, weighed down by a copper bowl of peaches. Hypatia's writing desk, perhaps. A clearly enchanted fire burned in the grate, the flames silver and blue. The smoke that rose from the fire traced delicate patterns on the air in the shape of acanthus leaves. Its smoke smelled sweet, like attar of roses.
"What do you think Charles is doing here?" Cordelia said.
James was studying the books on the walls, a very typically Herondale thing to do. "Where did you learn to dance like that?" he said abruptly. She turned to look at him in surprise. He was leaning against the bookshelf now, watching her.
"I had a dance instructor in Paris," she said.
"My mother believed that learning to dance aided in learning grace in battle. That dance," she added, "was forbidden to be taught to unmarried ladies, but my dance instructor did not care."
"Well, thank the angel you were there," he said. "Matthew and I could certainly not have pulled off that dance on our own."
Cordelia smiled wanly. On the stage, dancing, she had imagined that James was watching her, that he found her beautiful, and the power that had flooded through her at the thought had felt like electricity. Now she looked away from him, trailing her hand along the top of the desk, near the stack of papers held down by the copper bowl.
"Be careful," James said, with a quick warning gesture. "I suspect that is fairy fruit. It has no effect on warlocks, no magical effect at least, but on humans."
She drew back. "Surely it does not harm you if you do not eat it."
"Oh, it does not. But I have met those who have tasted it. They say the more you have of it, the more you want, and the more you ache when you can have no more. And yet, I have always thought, is not knowing what it tastes like just another form of torture? The torture of wondering." His words were light, but there was an oddness to the way he was looking at her, Cordelia thought, a sort of depth to his gaze that seemed unfamiliar. His lips were slightly parted, his eyes a deeper gold than usual. Beauty could tear at your heart like teeth, she thought. But she did not love James because he was beautiful. He was beautiful to her because she loved him. The thought brought hot blood to her cheeks. She glanced away, just as the door rattled in its frame. Someone was trying to get in. James whirled, his eyes wild. Cordelia's hand flew to the hilt of Cortana.
"We're not meant to be in here," she began.
She got no further. A moment later, James had pulled her toward him. His arms went round her, lifting her up and against him. His mouth was gentle, even as he crushed her against him. She realized what he was doing a beat later as the door opened and she heard voices on the threshold. She gave a little gasp and felt James's pulse jump. His right hand slid into her hair, his rune-scarred palm against her cheek as he kissed her. James was kissing her. She knew it wasn't real. She knew he was making it look as if they were downworlders having an assignation in the whispering room. But it didn't matter. Nothing mattered except the way he was kissing her, gloriously kissing her. She wrapped her arms around his neck, arching her body up against his. She felt his breath hiss out against her mouth. He was kissing her carefully, even as the movements of his hands and body mimicked passion. But she didn't want careful. She wanted it shattering and tremendous, wanted the passion to be real, the kissing to be the desperate everything she had always dreamed of. She opened her lips against James's. His was so soft, and he tasted of barley sugar and spice. She heard nervous laughter at the door of the room and felt James's hand tighten on her waist. His other hand left her cheek and cupped the back of her neck as he deepened the kiss, suddenly, as if he couldn't help himself. He leaned into it, into her, his tongue tracing the shape of her mouth, making her shudder.
Oh,
she whispered softly against him and heard the door close. Whoever it was had gone. She kept her arms around James's neck. If he wanted this over, he would have to end it. He broke off the kiss but didn't let her go. He was still holding her against him, his body a hard cradle for hers. She stroked the side of his neck with her fingers. There was a faint white scar just above his collar, in the shape of a star. His breathing went ragged.
Daisy. My Daisy. I think more people are coming, she whispered.
It wasn't true, and they both knew it. It didn't matter. He pulled her against him with such force she nearly tripped, her heel catching on the rug. Her shoe came off, and she kicked away the second one, going up on tiptoe to reach James's mouth. His lips were firm and sweet, teasing now as he ran them over the seam of her lips, over her cheekbone down to her jaw. She was swimming in dizziness as she felt him undo the strap of Cortana with one hand, his other hand tracing the bodice of her dress. She had never known her body could feel like this, tense and taut with desire, while at the same time she seemed to float. He kissed her throat as her head fell back. She felt him bend to lay Cortana against the wall. When he straightened, his arms tightened around her. He moved them both away from the bookcase, half carrying her, his mouth urgent against hers. They stumbled across the carpet, hands and lips frantic, as they fetched up against the massive desk. Cordelia arched backward, her hands gripping the desk's edge, her body curving into James's in a way that made him inhale sharply. His hands shaped the curves of her, sweeping from her hips to her waist, rising to cup her breasts. She gasped, breathing into the new sensation, wanting his hands on her. His fingers curved to hook into the neckline of her gown. He was touching her skin, her bare skin. She shivered in amazement and he looked at her, his eyes wild and hot and golden. He shrugged off his black frock coat, tossing it aside. When he came back to her, she could feel the heat of his body through her thin silk dress. Even in her dance, even in the training room, she had never felt her body so absolutely right as she did now. He lifted her onto the walnut desk, so she sat on a wooden perch above him. She wrapped her legs around his waist. He cradled her face between his hands. Her hair was a curtain of flames, streaming about both of them as they kissed and kissed. At last she drew him up. Her back met the wood of the desk as he leaned over her, one hand braced above her head. The feel of his body all along hers scorched her blood. She understood now why poets said love was like burning. The heat of it was all through her and in her, and all she wanted was more. More kisses, more touches, to be devoured by this like a forest by wildfire. And his face. She had never seen him like this. Eyes burning and lost to desire, his pupils wide and black. He groaned as she touched him, running her palms over his hard chest, his rigid arms holding him braced over her. She tangled her fingers in the dark riot of his hair as he bent to kiss the swell of each breast, his breath hot against her skin. The door to the room opened again. James froze, and a moment later scrambled up and off the desk, seizing his coat. He handed it to Cordelia as she sat up hurriedly. Matthew stood on the threshold, staring at them both. Cordelia clutched the coat to her, though she was still fully dressed. Still, it felt like something of a shield against Matthew's stunned gaze. James, he said, and he sounded as if he didn't quite believe the evidence of his own eyes. His expression was tense and sharp as his eyes flicked from James to Cordelia's shoes, discarded on the floor. We're not meant to be in here, Cordelia said hurriedly. James thought if we pretended... I mean, if someone came in and thought...
I understand, Matthew said, looking not at her but at James.
And James, Cordelia thought, looked composed, so composed, as if nothing had happened. Only his hair was mussed a little, and his tie askew, but his expression was unremarkable, calm, faintly curious.
Is Charles still here? He said.
Languidly, Matthew leaned against the doorframe. His hands moved slowly as he spoke, describing pale arcs in the air.
He left. He gave me quite a dressing down first, I can assure you, for spending my time in such a swamp of debauchery and ruin. He said he thought I would have at least brought you or Anna to look after me.
He grimaced.
Hard luck, old chap, said James, turning to Cordelia and reaching out a hand to help her down from the desk.
The heat had gone from his golden eyes. They were cool and unreadable. She handed him his coat and he shrugged it on.
Why was he here?
The Enclave is looking into what downworlders know about the situation, said Matthew.
Days after we already had the idea, of course.
We ought to leave, said James. Charles may have gone, but nothing prevents other Clave members from making an unwelcome appearance. We have to warn Anna, said Cordelia, clearing her throat. She thought she sounded remarkably steady, all things considered. Matthew's smile was brittle.
Hypatia won't like that.
Still, Cordelia said stubbornly, retrieving one shoe and then the other, we must. She took Cortana back from where James had leaned it against the wall and followed the boys out into the corridor. She bit her lip as they hurried down the damask-papered hallway in silence. The scent of the smoke in the whispering room clung to her hair and clothes, sickly sweet.
Here, Matthew said, as an ornately carved golden door rose up in front of them, its knob carved in the shape of a dancing nymph. It seemed Hypatia had altered the entrance to her room, just as she had altered the walls in the central chamber. The bedroom of Hypatia Vex. Cordelia, I assume you wish to knock.
Cordelia refrained from glaring at Matthew. He stood close to her, nearly shoulder to shoulder, and she could smell alcohol on him, something rich and dark like brandy or rum. She thought of the too slow deliberation of his gestures, the way he'd blinked at her and James. Before he had come to fetch them from the whispering room, he had gotten drunk, she realized. Probably far more drunk than he was letting on. Before she could move, the nymph knob turned, and Anna opened the door in a wash of bronze light and a heavy rush of scent, redolent of white flowers, jasmine and tuberose. Anna's hair was mussed, and the collar of her shirt hung open to display a ruby necklace, glimmering red as blood against her throat. She held a wooden box, carved with the Ouroboros, and dark with the patina of years in her left hand.
Shh, she whispered, glaring at them. Hypatia's asleep, but she won't stay that way long. Take it.
And she tossed the pyxis to James.
Then we're done, said Matthew. Come along with us. And make Hypatia suspicious. Don't be ridiculous.
Anna rolled her blue eyes.
Off you go, conspirators. I've done my part, and the rest of my evening will not require you.
Anna?
Hypatia's voice sounded from somewhere inside the bronze-lit room.
Anna, darling, where are you?
Take my carriage, Anna whispered. Then she smiled. And you did very well, Cordelia. They'll be talking about that dance for ages.
She winked and shut the door in their faces. Sleep eluded Cordelia that night. Long after the boys had dropped her at the house in Kensington, long after she had wearily climbed the steps to her bedroom, long after her new dress had been discarded in a pile of bronze silk on the floor, she lay awake, staring up at the white plaster ceiling of her room. She could still feel James's lips on hers, the touch of his hands and fingers on her body. He had kissed her with violent desperation, as if he were dying for her. He had said her name, Daisy, my Daisy, hadn't he? Yet when they had reached Kensington, he had helped her down from the carriage and bid her good night casually, as if they were simply the friends they had always been. She tried to hold the memory of what it felt like to kiss him in her mind, but it slipped away and vanished with only the memory of sweetness, like the smoke in the whispering room.
16. Legion. The sea gave up its dead, and death and the grave gave up their dead. Revelations 20:13.
When Cordelia arrived at the Institute in the late afternoon, she found Lucy and the merry thieves in the ballroom, clearly taking advantage of the fact that Will and Tessa had gone on a day patrol. White sheets had been thrown over the furniture and the piano, and the only light came from the arched windows, whose heavy velvet curtains had been pulled back. Even in the short time that had passed since the ball, the floor had grown lightly grained with dust. Lucy, Christopher, James, Matthew, and Thomas were standing in a circle around an object that had been placed in the middle of the room. As Cordelia drew near them, she recognised it as the pyxis Anna had handed to James the night before. In the watery daylight, Cordelia could see it more clearly. It was made of a dark golden wood, with the pattern of the Ouroboros, the snake swallowing its own tail, burned into four of its sides. A handle protruded from the top.
"Cordelia!" Lucy exclaimed. "We were just exchanging information. We learned a great deal that was important at the Enclave meeting last night, and it sounds as if you did something or other at the Hell Ruel. Nothing that compelling, no doubt, but we cannot all be spies."
"I heard about the meeting from my brother this morning," said Cordelia, joining the others in their makeshift circle. Like Cordelia, Lucy and the boys were in gear. James wore a Norfolk jacket over his, with the storm collar turned up. Locks of black hair tumbled over his forehead and kissed the tops of his cheekbones. She looked away quickly before their eyes could meet.
"The quarantine and all the rest."
Alistair was still angry at her, but to be fair to him, he had been gentle in breaking the bad news about Oliver Haywood. She did not know what to say about it now, though. She had not known Oliver, except as a presence at Barbara's side, but the others had. She could not imagine what they felt, especially Thomas, who looked even more tense and strained than he had before. "It seems even more urgent to find and trap the demon responsible for this contagion now, before it attacks anyone else," she said at last. Christopher enthusiastically waved an enormous book he was holding, his glasses balanced on the tip of his nose. The words "On the Uses of Pyxites and Other Phylacteries" were stamped across the front in gold. "It appears that this generation of pyxis is fairly simple. When you wish to trap a demon, you first wound or weaken it. Then you place the pyxis on the ground nearby and speak the words Tham Tholach Thachembaor, and the demon will be sucked into the box." The pyxis wobbled sharply, nearly tipping onto its side. Everyone jumped about a foot back.
"It's alive," Thomas said, staring. "Not the pyxis, I mean. Well, you know what I mean."
"Indeed," said James. "I see a flaw in our plan." Matthew nodded.
"I do as well. What if the pyxis has an occupant? There is no real reason to assume the box at Hypatia's was empty. It could have had a demon in it all these years."
They all stared at each other.
"What would happen if we tried to put another demon in there?" Cordelia asked at last. "Could they both fit?"
"It isn't a good idea," said Christopher, consulting the book. "Since we don't know what kind of demon is already in there, we don't know if there will be enough space. Pyxides are bigger inside than they appear, but still finite."
"Well, Then we have to empty this pyxis out, Lucy said practically. Anything could be in there. It could be a greater demon.
What ho, said Christopher sadly. I'm sure it isn't, said James. Still, let's relocate to the sanctuary. No matter what happens, we can at least keep it contained until help arrives.
Why not? Said Matthew. Surely there's no way this plan can go wrong.
James raised an eyebrow. Have you got another idea?
I think we should do it, said Thomas.
It's ridiculous to come this far and turn back.
Lucy sniffed.
Well, you'd all better hope it works, especially you, James, because if Mum and Papa find out you released a demon in the sanctuary, they will feed you to it.
James shot Lucy a dark older brother glare that almost made Cordelia giggle. She had always been a little jealous of the closeness James and Lucy shared, something she had always wanted with Alistair but never had. It was nice that at some moments they were perfectly ordinary. They relocated themselves to the sanctuary, James carrying the pyxis carefully, as if it were an infernal device that might explode at any moment. Cordelia found herself walking beside James and Lucy. She wondered if she and James would ever discuss what had happened the night before in the whispering room, or if she would be left to go quietly mad wondering about it.
Don't worry, Lucy said to her brother. It won't be like it was with Papa.
What do you mean? Cordelia asked.
James said, When he was a child, my father opened a pyxis with tragic consequences. My Aunt Ella was killed. Cordelia was horrified.
Maybe we shouldn't. This will be different, Lucy said,
and Cordelia wasn't sure if Lucy was reassuring herself or James.
We know what we're getting into. Papa didn't.
They had arrived at the sanctuary, the only room in the Institute where downworlders could freely enter without being invited in by a shadow hunter. It was warded all over with spells, preventing them from entering the main body of the Institute. Meetings with prominent downworlders were often held there, and downworlders could even seek refuge in a sanctuary under the Accords. It was certainly clear that the London Institute had once been a cathedral, and a large one. Massive stone pillars stretched up to a vaulted roof. Thomas had produced a box of vestas and was moving around the room, lighting a dozen enormous candelabras, their sconces stuffed with fat white candles that cast a glimmering light. The tapestries and pillars were all traced with the designs of runes, as were the tiles of the floor. Cordelia had to admit that if one was going to release a demon, this seemed one of the better places to do it. In the middle of the room was a dry stone fountain, in the centre of which stood the statue of an angel with folded wings, its stone face streaked with black lines like tears. James set the box on the floor, directly on top of a rune of angelic power. He knelt down, studying the pyxis. After a moment, he took an unlit seraph blade from the inside of his coat. "Arm yourselves, everyone," he said. Cordelia unsheathed Cortana. The others drew seraph blades as James had done, save Thomas, who took out his bolus. James reached out and took hold of the handle of the pyxis. Cordelia's hand tightened on the hilt of her sword. James twisted the handle sideways, as if turning a corkscrew. There was a loud click as the pyxis popped open. All through the sanctuary, the white candles spat and guttered. James sprang back, raising his blade. There was a sound like the whistle of a train at night, and smoke billowed from the open pyxis, bringing with it a foul, burnt smell. Cordelia coughed, raising Katana. She heard James call out, "Barachiel!" And the light of his seraph blade cut through the smoke, followed by the blades of the others, Matthew, Christopher, and Lucy. Something was rising through the smoke. Something like a massive caterpillar, greenish in colour, with a segmented, undulating body and a smooth head slashed across by a lipless mouth. The mouth cracked open, showing row upon row of blackened teeth. Then, to Cordelia's surprise, it spoke.
At last I am free,
it hissed.
I, a Galliarept, am free to recover the domain of my master, stolen from him by a demon of great cunning. I shall retrieve his lost world and flood this one with blood and death.
Its blind head turned toward the shadow hunters.
Those who have freed me, what is thy bidding? Speak. I am commanded to do anything you ask.
Anything? Said Matthew curiously. There was a flash of light as James's seraph blade arced through the smoke and plunged into the demon's middle. Black ichor sprayed as the demon shrieked in a high, chittering voice. The candles gutted and went out as James pulled his blade free. He was spattered with black fluid, his jaw set, his eyes glittering. The demon howled and vanished, leaving only smoke and stink behind. Lucy staggered back, coughing, her face screwed up in disgust.
But it would have done our bidding, Matthew protested.
It seemed untrustworthy, said James, wiping ichor from his face with his sleeve. His seraph blade had gone dark.
I thought he seemed all right, for a demon, said Christopher. You know? What is going on here? Said a loud voice.
They all spun around, Cordelia raising Cortana reflexively. She waved smoke away from her face and stared. Someone had come in through the door to the street outside. A tall man, very tall, with a shock of black hair. His skin was brown, a shade darker than Cordelia's own, his eyes gold-green and slit-pupiled like a cat's. He was dressed as if for a summer wedding, in a grey frock coat and trousers, with grey suede gloves and boots. The outfit was topped off by a magnificent waistcoat of grey and magenta brocade, a walking stick, and bright magenta spats.
Magnus Bane, said Matthew, with a mixture of amazement and horror.
Magnus Bane walked some distance into the sanctuary, shaking his head as he studied the scene before him.
I want to know what you're doing, but I must confess I'm afraid to find out, he said. A spot of demon summoning, I gather.
It's a bit complicated, said James. Hello, Magnus. It's good to see you.
Last time I saw you, you were face down in the Serpentine, Magnus said cheerfully. Now you're fiddling with a pyxis. I see you have decided to follow in the long Herondale tradition of poor decision-making.
So have I,
said Lucy, determined not to be left out.
I came all the way from Jakarta to have a meeting with Tessa and Will about this whole daylight demon plague business, Magnus said. Yet when I knocked on the front door, no one answered. Thus I was forced to come in through the sanctuary.
It's odd they would have asked you to come here now, said Thomas. Everyone over 18 is out searching for the demons responsible for the attacks. Magnus furrowed his brow. He lifted his hand to stare at the expensive-looking watch on his wrist and groaned.
It seems that I forgot to turn my watch backward, and therefore I have arrived 6 hours early. Bloody hell.
Matthew looked delighted.
We could have tea. I am a true enthusiast of your work, Mr. Bane. Also, your personal style, your waistcoats alone.
Matthew, do shut up, said Thomas. Mr. Bane doesn't want to talk about waistcoats.
Untrue, said Magnus. I always want to talk about waistcoats. But I admit I'm more curious about this pyxis.
He drew closer and poked at the box with his Malacca walking stick.
Am I correct in deducing that you opened the box on purpose and let a palpus demon out?
Yes, said James.
Why? Said Magnus.
We need to be able to use the pyxis, Matthew burst out, to trap a demon, so it had to be empty. We were just clearing it out.
James sighed. Matthew, you would be a terrible spy. You might not break under torture, but you'd tell someone anything they wanted to know in exchange for a nice pair of trousers.
Oh, for goodness sake, Cordelia said. She turned to Magnus. You want this demon business over, right? You don't want any more shadow hunters to die. Magnus looked startled to be addressed so forcefully.
I am generally not on the side of murderous demons, no.
Then perhaps you could help us, James said, and quickly outlined their plan, or at least as much of it as he could tell without breaking faith with Ragnar. Their belief that they were seeking a kind of demon that could only be trapped by a pixis. James's vision of the Shadow Realm, and the reason to think that the demon would be on Tower Bridge. As he spoke, Magnus looked more and more curious. By the end of the story, Magnus had seated himself on the edge of the fountain, his long legs stretched out in front of him. This is quite a collection of suppositions, he said when James was done. But I must ask, especially you, Lucy and James, why do you not seek your parents' assistance with this? Why the secrecy?
Because we made a promise, said Matthew, to the person who gave us the key that unlocked a great deal of this information, and we can't break it.
Magnus smiled an odd, sideways smile.
Ragnar told me that he trusted you with some information, and it appears that you have not betrayed his trust. Not many shadow hunters would honor such a vow made to a downworlder. Since I am Ragnar's best friend, or at least the only person who can tolerate him for long stretches, I will keep your secret.
He glanced from James to Lucy.
In days past, when I knew your parents well, they probably would have been spearheading this plan.
He stood up.
But now they are no longer children. They are parents, and thus devoted to something they love more than their own lives. So indeed, perhaps they should not be told.
Even Matthew had no response to that.
Well, good luck, Magnus said, picking up his walking stick. I suppose I shall go to Hatchard's for a few hours. There is no better distraction in this world than losing oneself in books for a while.
Cordelia stepped forward, her hands held out as if to prevent him from leaving. Mr. Bane, she said, I know it is a great deal to ask, especially when you have promised to keep our secrets, but would you help us? Magnus tapped gloved fingers on the head of his cane.
You're a Carstairs, right? Cordelia Carstairs?
Yes, I'm Jem's cousin, Cordelia said. Look, we know this is a wild plan, but it could save many lives. You needn't help us directly or get involved in the fighting. I understand you feel loyalty to our parents, but you could help us very much just by casting a spell to keep mundanes off Tower Bridge while we venture onto it. It would be safer for them, too.
Magnus hesitated. It was utterly silent in the sanctuary.
Cordelia imagined she could hear the sound of the blood pounding in her ears as Magnus considered her request. At last, the warlock shrugged a silk-suited shoulder.
Very well, he said. Even though that green bastard Ragnar has haired off to Capri, I don't think he would have wanted you to put yourselves in danger because of a promise to him. I'll keep an eye on you. But remember, if I see anything I think Will and Tessa need to know, I will tell them about it post-haste.
After gathering what they needed from the weapons room, James was loaded down with more than a dozen of Christopher's specially designed throwing knives, the group made their way down Ludgate Hill and Cannon Street as the sun set over the city. James caught himself stealing glances at Cordelia when he was sure he wouldn't be observed. She was deep in conversation with Lucy, their heads bent together as they walked. Cordelia's flame-dark hair had been pulled back into a smooth chignon, leaving the light brown nape of her neck exposed. James tried not to think about the fact that he knew what it was like to curl his fingers around the back of that neck while he kissed her mouth. He was sure that if he did think about it, it would drive him mad, and he would be no further use to anyone. Those moments in the whispering room with Cordelia had been like nothing else in his life. No other experience was comparable, and certainly no moment with Grace. But what did that say about him? Hadn't he loved Grace, and wasn't love the same as desire? Didn't the one grow from the other? And he couldn't love Cordelia. It wasn't possible for him to have been in love with Grace mere days ago and have transferred his affections so quickly. He wished to talk to Cordelia, desperately. But what on earth would he say? He couldn't tell her he loved her, but neither could he express regret for what had happened the night before. If he had to choose between a long life of peace and happiness and another 5 minutes like the one he'd spent with Cordelia in the Whispering Room, he dared not guess what he would choose.
Are you all right?
To James's surprise, Magnus had joined him as they passed the Church of St. Margaret Patton's.
I have to admit, Magnus added, I had been hoping to talk to you tonight, so perhaps this development is fortuitous.
Why would you be hoping to talk to me? James slid his hands into the pockets of his gear jacket. It buttoned closely to the body, allowing for ease of movement while fighting. If you are concerned that I have continued my career of shooting chandeliers, you will be relieved to know that according to the Clave, I have moved on to vandalizing greenhouses. Magnus merely raised an eyebrow.
Henry, he said. Before he went to Idris, he sent me a vial of dirt to analyze, said he couldn't make head or tail of it. He also said you gave it to him.
James had nearly forgotten that Magnus and Henry were good friends and had, famously, invented the magic that powered portals together. And? He said cautiously.
It's strange stuff, Magnus said. In fact, it isn't from this world.
They had reached the bottom of Great Tower Street and were nearing the Tower of London. Flags waved from the turrets of the White Tower, backlit dimly against the last fitful gleams of the setting sun. Magnus nimbly avoided a group of tourists with box cameras and steered James down Tower Hill, a hand on his shoulder. James lowered his voice, though the others were a distance away. Matthew, who was carrying the pyxis, had stopped to point out something about the tower to Cordelia.
What do you mean? You know that there are other realms, said Magnus, other worlds than this.
Think of the universe, then, as like a honeycomb, each of its chambers a different realm, so some chambers lie next to one another. Demons come from them, yes, they travel through the dimensions to reach our world and others.
Magnus nodded. There are some worlds ruled by demons, usually greater demons. Those worlds can be imbued with the very essence of those creatures. The dirt you gave Henry comes from one such place, a dimension under the power of the demon Belphegor.
Belphegor? The name was immediately familiar. He's one of the princes of hell, isn't he?
I know what you're thinking about, said Magnus, tapping his walking stick against the cobblestones. Jem also contacted me about you. All roads lead to James Herondale these days, it seems.
James rubbed his cold hands together. The wind off the river was sharp. Jem contacted you.
About your grandfather, said Magnus. He told me that he was a prince of hell.
He glanced at the darkening sky.
You are wondering now if it might be Belphegor because the realm that you visit belongs to him.
Wouldn't that make a kind of sense? Said James.
It might. It might mean nothing at all. I can tell you that there is no record of anyone sighting Belphegor in more than a century.
Magnus hesitated.
Jem told me you were desperate to know who your grandfather is. My own father is a prince of hell.
They are dark angels, James, intelligent and cunning and manipulative. They bear the knowledge of thousands of years of life. Like angels, they have seen the face of the divine, but they turned away from it. They have chosen darkness, and that choice has reverberated through eternity. They cannot be killed, only wounded, and no good can come from knowing a prince of hell. They can never cause you anything but sorrow.
But wouldn't it be better for me to know? I summoned my father once. It was the worst mistake of my life.
James,
You are not defined by this blood in you. I have found no trace, no hint of who your grandfather is, and I advise Jem to cease looking. It does not matter. You are who you are, made by the sum of your choices and actions, not a teaspoon of demon's blood. So you don't think it's Belphegor, said James. What about Samael? Magnus snorted. Good Lord, you are determined. I recall seeking a demon for your father once. He was equally stubborn. He pointed with his walking stick. Look, here we are. They were in front of the bridge. Though it was quite dark now and the gas lamps were lit, there was still a good amount of traffic, even the occasional motor car purring along Tower Bridge approach. The others had begun to gather around. Reluctantly, James dropped the topic of his grandfather. So, do you think you can do it? He asked Magnus. Create a distraction, or should we come back later when there are fewer mundanes about? Magnus's eyes glittered. No need for that, he said. He stepped to the railing along the river's edge, where a high wall dropped down to a stony beach that ran beside and below the bridge. With a flourish, he drew off his gloves and tucked them into his waistcoat pocket. Then he held out his hands. Blue fire sparked at his fingertips. Light arced over the Thames. Bright as a thousand naphtha beacons, it formed a glimmering path laid from bank to bank of the Thames. James heard Cordelia gasp in wonder as the light rose and twined, forming the ghostly shape of a shimmering tower bridge made of light. It was perfect down to the last detail, from the towers to the spiderweb cables and gleaming chains. Magnus lowered his hands. He was breathing hard. It's spectacular, said Thomas, and there was a look of real wonder on his face that James was glad to see. But it will not appear to mundanes as it does to you, said Magnus. They will not see the real bridge. They will see this instead. Look. He indicated an oncoming hansom cab with a wave of his hand. The small group of shadow hunters gaped as it swung toward the glimmering illusion of Tower Bridge and onto the bridge deck. The wheels of the hansom rattled over the glimmering tarmac. Oh, good. I was afraid the bridge was going to collapse, said Lucy, as more carriages followed the cab. Magnus seemed to have thrown up a glamour over the entrance to the real bridge, as all the traffic, pedestrian and even omnibuses, seemed to be swerving unconsciously toward Magnus's secondary, shining structure. Magnus would never create a bridge that would collapse, said Matthew. His green eyes were shining, and James felt a rush of affection for his parapetai. Matthew had always loved magic. It was probably why he seemed so at home in the Hell Ruel and places like it, surrounded by enchanted fire and starry-eyed warlocks. Thank you, said Magnus dryly. If you're going to capture that demon, you'd better get to it. I can only keep this illusion going for so long. James inclined his head. Thank you. Magnus just shook his head slightly. Good luck. Don't get killed. James had already turned and was making his way through the archway that led to the steps up to the bridge, the others close behind and around him. All of them held seraph blades except Cordelia. As always, Cortana glimmered in her hand. James had thought there seemed a sort of shadow hanging over the bridge, a darkness that he had attributed to the shadow of the glamour Magnus had cast.